Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and our first guest today is Daryl Morrison, a landscape designer and educator who has taught ecology-based landscape design at the UW-Madison, at the University of Georgia. Daryl lived and worked in New York City, now lives in Madison, where he's an honorary faculty associate in the Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture at the UW-Madison. And he's an author of a new book. It's titled Beauty of the Wild, A Life Designing Landscapes Inspired by Nature. So, do you prefer gardens that are based on nature? What would you like to know about creating one? Love to hear from you, and I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address, ideas@wpr.org. Again, love to hear from you. Daryl Morrison, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Larry. Nice to be here.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you here. You've been a landscape designer for over 60 years, and a lot of the books written by designers are a bit more, technical in their nature, points 1, 2, 3, 4, that sort of thing. Your book, it seems a bit more philosophical in a way. I think it gets across the same points, but in maybe a little more philosophical way. Would you describe it that way?
Yeah, actually, I'm flattered by your thinking that that it is philosophical, but indeed it does express my philosophy toward landscape and landscape design. So that I think is accurate.
Well, it's part of a biography as well, isn't it?
Right. It's a memoir, which reminds me of a quote from Jill Kerr Conway, who wrote memoirs, in which she said, "Memoirs are a special type of fiction."
There you go. Well, I've got to tell you, Daryl, you write beautifully, and with the wonderful photography that is included in your book, it makes just such a pleasant read. And thank you so much for writing it and putting it together.
Thank you.
It was really interesting to read that you and your brothers, you grew up on a farm and you all became involved in the arts in one way or another. That seems a bit unusual. Why do you think that happened?
I think we owe it to our parents. I remember very well when we were growing up on that farm in Iowa. Every winter we would go on a Sunday afternoon to the Des Moines Art Center, which was a new facility at that time. And we saw this abstract expressionist art and a wonderful building by Saarinen. And I think that really did have an influence on all three of us.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and this whole business of being attuned to the landscape and the beauty of a landscape that you apparently all have is amazing. Are we born? Can a person be born with that, or is it, as you say, maybe a parental or other sort of influence?
I guess it's hard to say. I guess you have to have the capacity for it, and then with the right influences, you go in that direction.
Yeah, you did your graduate work at Wisconsin, and that turned into a job as a lecturer. I'm wondering, how did that influence your work as a designer?
Oh, my coming to Madison, to UW for grad school was totally instrumental in everything I've done since then. I had read a book when I was working back in Maryland, entitled American Plants for American Gardens, which had been written in 1929 by a plant ecologist, Edith Roberts, and a landscape architect, Elsa Raymond. And in reading that book, I just felt the need to learn more about ecology myself. So I was searching around for a grad program, and University of Wisconsin, of course, came up on top as being a leader in that field. So I came here in 1967 as a new grad student. And that literally turned my life around. I'd been doing some pretty pedestrian landscape design using thousands of vinca minor and English ivy, and hadn't really heard the term plant communities until I read that book, and that indeed was the starting point for me. And then coming to Wisconsin, of course, seeing Curtis Prairie at the Arboretum, the first prairie restoration in the world, and I was so impressed by how beautiful that landscape, which had been, quote, designed by scientists, how beautiful that was. And it was, of course, based on natural prairies and savannas and other plant communities in Wisconsin.
You worked, you team taught with Evelyn Howell. And
indeed, yeah.
And got a lot out of, it sounded like you guys had an enjoyable time teaching and learning as you went along.
Right. I do think we taught each other. She certainly taught me a lot. I hope I taught her something.
Oh, man. Well, I know in your book you talk about Jensen, and I think you said that Jensen had the biggest impact on you in your life, in your life's work. Maybe talk a bit about Jensen and then how somebody you never met had such an influence.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, I guess I first really learned about him when I came to Wisconsin to grad school. And after I got my master's degree and was on the faculty here, I felt I needed to go to the clearing, the school that he started up at Ellison Bay in Door County. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Maybe I cut out. Anyway, but seeing the clearing, which he established in 1935 at the age of 75, was really, really had a big impact on me. And, of course, I had read a book called Landscape Artists in America, which was about Jensen and his work, written by Leonard Eaton. And so the more I learned about it, the more I valued him. And he was a master of spatial manipulation, so to speak, forming spaces with plants. That became a lesson I tried to get across to students very early on. We don't decorate spaces, we create spaces with plants. And that's fairly key in what I do. But anyway, Jensen worked in the Chicago parks after arriving in this country from Denmark in 1885. And he was with the Chicago parks basically until 1920 with a little break. And then in 1920, he started a private practice in Ravinia, Illinois. And in 1934, his wife died, and he decided to move to Door County, where he'd been acquiring 128 acres for some time on the shores of Green Bay, with a view of the setting sun over Green Bay. And but anyway, the way he handled space and light and contrast between light and shadow in his design was very powerful, I thought. And then he started actually using plants from anywhere when he first arrived in this country. And then he spent time in the field with Henry Coles, C-O-W-L-E-S, an ecologist at the University of Chicago. And the more time he spent in the field, the more he became impressed with the beauty of native natural landscapes. And so that got him started. But anyway, it's just been a very long period when I've observed and appreciated his work so much. And I taught, actually, at the clearing from 1973 until 2003 for a week every other summer. So I had a lot of exposure to the clearing and the spaces that he had designed there. And I started up again in 2015, taught at the clearing. I taught again in 2017. And I just learned yesterday that I'll be teaching there in 22.
Oh, good for you. Oh, man, that will be a very, very popular class, I'm sure. This whole business about ecologically sound having an area that is equally ecologically sound turns some people off because they think, I think as you pointed out, it means having to give up something. But that's not true, is it?
No, it definitely is not true, certainly in my opinion. People feel that if you're following a native plant community approach, that it limits you. But in fact, I like to point out, we have so many native species in our natural prairies and savannas and woods that there's just no end to the diversity we can put into a designed landscape. And then if we, in doing that, if we somehow emulate the natural patterns in nature, it is a very rich aesthetic. And I also have the feeling that if you put plants together that naturally grow together, that the aesthetics work out very well. It's when we introduce something from somewhere else that we lose the intactness of a regional landscape. I can't help mentioning what happens if you have a oak hickory forest, for example, and you put a Colorado blue spruce in at the edge. It is totally jarring.
Well, and you study an area. This has been your procedure, I think, for your pretty much your professional career. You study an area carefully before you when you're asked to design an area. You study it very carefully, even
for sure.
Sleep on it sometimes in that area. Talk about that. Why that's important?
Well, number one, you can read books, and there are certainly books that are extremely helpful. And in Wisconsin, we have what I consider to be the Bible on native plant communities in John Curtis's book, The Vegetation of Wisconsin. So you can get a lot from that, where you learn what the primary species are in a particular type of environment, and also how it changes over time. But to get the real feel of the place, the essence of the place, you really have to be out there and feel the breeze, feel the wind, and see it at different times of day, different times of night. And so you really understand it. You feel it. There's an emotional link there, I think, too.
And that in the end, that informs what you're going to do with that area.
Exactly. Yeah. When I worked on the Native Wisconsin Garden, Native Plant Garden at the Arboretum here, I spent about a week on the site in 1997, just getting as familiar with it as I could. Learn the different microclimates, the different soil conditions, and how that might match up with southern Wisconsin plant communities.
We have callers online with some questions for you. Let's just go to Mike in Sun Prairie. Mike, thanks for calling.
Thanks, Larry. Good morning. Love your show. My question was around, we definitely try to do some flowering gardens to really attract pollinators. If I want to transfer that philosophy to my vegetable garden, are there certain vegetables that are better for like bees particularly, or will attract more bees than other vegetables?
Hmm. Well,
how would you approach something like that, Daryl?
Well, I don't really have a solid good answer. I don't have a list of vegetable crops that would attract pollinators. But I will say, in general, the more diversity you have in the planting, the more likely you are to attract pollinators of various sorts, whether it be a totally native garden or a vegetable garden. But I don't have a list of vegetables that I know to be particularly attractive to pollinators.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Mike. Appreciate the call. Our guest today, Daryl Morrison, his book is called Beauty of the Wild, A Life Designing Landscapes Inspired by Nature. You can join in with your questions or comments about his book or other areas as well. The number is 800-642-1234. You could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau is our producer today. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. So happy to have you with us today on the Ideas Network as we visit with Daryl Morrison about his book, Beauty of the Wild, A Life-Designing Landscape Inspired by Nature. I like to think it's a philosophical book, a bit of a biography in some respects. But the points that he makes in the book are so well supported by the wonderful photography of the places that where the places where he's worked, and you get it helps give you a sense of what he's going for, or what he envisions as an appropriate way to design a landscape. Daryl, you have maybe 3-4 principles in mind. I think you mentioned 4. When you are looking at a particular area, I think one had to do with the species that are adapted to the area. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm groping a little bit. There are 4 characteristics that I have try to incorporate into a design, and these have grown out of reading the work of environmental psychologists Steve and Rachel Kaplan at the University of Michigan. They talk about in the landscape something that is appealing to people are these four characteristics. First, mystery. Second, complexity. Third, coherence. And fourth, legibility. I don't know if this isn't quite the same.
Yeah, no.
But anyway, I do think those are really good characteristics to shoot for in a designed landscape. Mystery being that you can't see everything at once, that something will be revealed as you come around a corner, so to speak. Complexity refers to complexity of lines, forms, colors, and textures, but also species diversity in the landscape. And then coherence comes from the fact that it's not just a random mix of native species, but there are patterns, there are what I like to call drifts, where there's a density, a particular density of one species, and then it may phase out, and another species picks up in sort of a relay form, so that the complexity has coherence in it. And legibility refers to your ability to see how you will move through the landscape, so you don't feel claustrophobic or lost. And that very often happens in nature, too. And I like to use the terms rivers and drifts. The rivers become the open spaces that you would move through, sort of like a river moves through a landscape. And then the drifts are the vegetation on the banks of the river at any scale, whether it be shrubs or tall grasses or even trees.
And the river, I can recall the waving of the grasses are almost like the waves of a river in some of the designs you've done.
Right, or even ocean-like in the larger one.
Yeah, and you've done some pretty large ones, that's for sure. Well, Michael in Wauwatosa, let's go to you. Hi, Michael.
Hi, I just had a comment about, you know, I have a horticulture background in college from the 80s, and also ecology of the upper Midwest, where I was exposed to Dr. Curtis's book, John Curtis's book. Mm-hmm. Anyway, in our horticulture teaching, we were always, you know, excited about the next new thing coming out of the nurseries that was bred, you know, maybe could have been from Asia or something. And in horticulture, you're looking for these new varieties. And it was something we kind of like relished to be, oh, this is a new plant here. We should check that out and try this. And I totally did a pivot once I actually read Douglas Talmay's book about how important the native species are and the insects that feed on them. And now I would never plant anything but a native. And I relish insect damage on my plants because I know that I'm helping feed the native insects. you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm definitely going to be looking for your book and reading that. But my comment was, as a horticulturalist, we were taught to look for the new stuff, and we should have been really cultivating the natives all along.
I won't argue with that.
Yeah,
I believe it.
Go ahead, Daryl.
As I said earlier, there is so much diversity out there in the native landscape, and we're missing a bet if we don't incorporate a lot of that diversity for many reasons, including the attractiveness to pollinators, but also the beauty for us people. Yeah. And then the fact that there are pollinators in the landscape adds another dimension for the people who are in that landscape as well. It's surrounded by butterflies and bumblebees and things like that.
Yeah. Michael, thank you so much. Denny in Fitchburg, your turn. Hi, Denny.
Good morning, Larry, everyone.
Hi.
There was a guy a couple calls back that was wondering about what vegetables he might plant. You know, some people have ideas about companion planting, whether it's effective or not, and I've been reading, and I do put native plants right in and around my vegetable garden, and that works very well. But I've also noticed that I love to eat fennel, and if I don't catch it before it bolts, it goes to flower, and I have noticed at least four different species of bees on the same plant. They love fennel flowers, and I wish I could have a field of it and make fennel honey. You know, the stuff just takes care of itself if I plant it. And the companion planting readings say fennel needs kind of to be by itself. Other plants don't really care for it. So just plant it and let it go seed, let it bolt, and you'll have it.
Denny, great. Thank you so much for calling. Comment, Daryl?
Oh, I concur completely. And intermingling some natives with the vegetables sounds like a very good idea for sure. I have a little rooftop garden right outside my window. I'm gazing at it even now, where I have cedar planters in which I have all native species, but I have some ceramic planters where I have things like fennel and parsley and a variety of herbs. And they certainly are compatible, although I do have this policy whereby the cedar planters are all native and the ceramic planters can be native or not.
There you go. Denny, thank you. Ellen in Neosho, your turn. Hi, thanks for calling.
Good morning, Larry and guest. This is just such a timely program. I have a remnant of southern mesic forest on my property that I'm restoring, and one of the species in that southern mesic forest is sugar maple. But what mm-hmm. I'm wondering is, with the climate changes that we're experiencing, the, you know, weeks of drought and then pounding rains and increased temperatures, is sugar maple a viable species for, say, the next 20, 30, 40 years? What do you think?
Well, I think it is. I did teach in Georgia, and then I've been in Wisconsin a lot too. And what I try to look for is how far south sugar maple is growing now, and it may be impossible for it to grow very far south in the future. But I think it's good here for quite some time. And then red maple, I know, is totally tolerant of Georgia conditions and would not be equivalent to sugar maple, but it would also have a beautiful fall color, which you would find attractive. But I would rule out something that's growing here now, because it may well have tolerance to a changed climate. So I wouldn't be in a hurry to replace the sugar maple.
Okay. Well, yeah, this whole business of climate change, as you think about it, would that impact in any way your own thoughts about the plants, that looking at the plants that already exist and are native to an area?
Mm-hmm.
Have you thought much about climate change as it relates to that?
I do think about it. I think, again, referring back to the Southeast, the places that it is, climate change is really going to diminish some of the diversity is in the high elevation. There's red spruce, for example, and fir tree that grows in Smoky Mountains. It will only grow above 5,000 feet because it's too warm below that. And as it gets warmer and warmer, it'll be pushed off the top of the mountain, so to speak, and there won't be a place for it. But I think where we don't have that big elevation change, it may not be as dramatic.
You mentioned Georgia. I think it was in the 80s you became dean of the School of Environmental Design at the University of Georgia, which I thought the story of how you wound up in that position was kind of it's kind of funny. I got a chuckle out of it.
Yeah, I didn't think I would get in.
You kind of went there thinking that there was no way they were ever going to hire you, so you were pretty much at ease through the whole process.
Totally relaxed.
What about your work in Georgia?
Well, when I got to Georgia, I transferred my approach to planting design. Very similarly, I learned as much as I could about native plant communities in Georgia, again, collaborating with a scientist, a taxonomist at the University of Georgia. And I learned as much as I could about plant communities and then tried to incorporate those in the design projects I did. Although I was not doing much designing then because I was deaning. I didn't have all that much time. But certainly the approach is good wherever you go to learn the native communities and then match them up with design sites that have similar characteristics, moisture-wise, soil-wise, and otherwise.
You know, you kind of surprised me in a way, although you explain it very well. You were at Wisconsin, then you were in Georgia at the University of Georgia, but then you wind up heading off to New York City. I thought, well, wow, when I first, I'm first reading that, I'm thinking, why would somebody who likes the kind of work that you were in? But then, of course, as we read on, we see that the reasons that talk a bit about that.
Yeah, well, I have to tell you one little story first. When I was teaching at Georgia, I taught a course called Landscape Ecology. And in one of my lectures, I showed work I had done in Texas and in Utah and in Wisconsin. And one of my students very legitimately asked the question, how can you know enough about the plants in all those places to work with them? And my answer was, well, I try to work with somebody who knows more than I do. And I really do. I try to work with local knowledge, people who know the area. And then, of course, the student asked another legitimate question when he said, so why did they hire you?
How did you respond to that?
I think I said something, well, I put it all together.
Oh, I love that. That's a great story. But back to New York.
Yeah, there's a thread through the book, in fact, in which I hope I'm making clear that is collaboration between disciplines is really important. So we need to work with ecologists and soil scientists as well. So that's another aspect of the book. But back to New York, I found it really fascinating, actually, to move from Wisconsin to Georgia to New York, because in New York I see plants that I knew in Wisconsin, and in the New Jersey Pine Barrens, for example, I see bog plants that I saw in northern Wisconsin, but I see sandhills plants that I knew in Georgia. And you start to see these big patterns where certain things carry over from one region to another, or maybe a different species of the same genus occurs in another part of the country. And that's just totally intriguing as you're learning more about a particular place. And the work I did in New York incorporated a lot of Wisconsin vegetation, certainly, in the New York Botanical Garden. A lot of things that we planted there also grow very well in Wisconsin, and some grow very well in Georgia. But if you look, and I always try to find the literature first that relates to a particular region, and then try to spend time in the field, and preferably with an ecologist or a botanist who knows the area better than I do. And there's a lot of value in that. I did work on a project at Brooklyn Botanic Garden, which tried to sort of create vignettes of the pine barrens of New Jersey. And I went with the botanist from Brooklyn Botanic Garden, and we literally studied the New Jersey pine barrens for the composition. And I was able to try to translate that into Brooklyn, right on Flatbush Avenue.
Well, the results of all your work are just stunning, and we're able to. That's another. I mentioned the photography in the book before, but just to mention it again, that it's really enlightening to hear you talk about what you're thinking about in terms of a landscape, and then seeing the results and understanding really much more fully what you were driving at.
Right, right. And I have to commend one of the photographers, especially, namely Robert Yeager from Madison, who photographed many of the photographs in the University Arboretum Native Plant Garden. Just fantastic work, including the cover of the book.
Yeah.
And give him kudos.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Jason in Galesville has something for us. Let's just go there. Jason, hi.
Hi. I was wondering if there are any, like, highly endangered or extinct native species that is, like, gone forever.
From Wisconsin, yeah.
Yes.
There's certainly a number that are on the brink. They're endangered and very rare. The Department of Natural Resources has a section on the rare and endangered plants. And my former student, Sydney Holtz, was working there until she retired a couple of years ago. But there are people concerned about that. And even some of the guidebooks indicate whether a particular species is rare or endangered, even by the county in which it occurs. And that is something else that I try to weave through the book, namely the importance of preservation of species. And this is most likely done by protecting land from incompatible development. And so the importance of protecting land will help protect species. But I also think there's a role for us who are designing with plants to incorporate plants that are not widely used so that they continue to have a home too.
Jason, thank you so much. Appreciate your call very much. Wanted to maybe go back to your all-time favorite garden design project, which was the native plant garden at the UW Arboretum, and kind of the story behind that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. Well, as I said, I taught field classes here in Wisconsin from 1973 to 83, co-teaching with ecologist Evelyn Howell during most of that time. And so I became familiar firsthand with a lot of the native plant communities. And then in 1997, Greg Armstrong at the UW Arboretum contacted me about doing a design of their native plant garden, 4-acre garden surrounding an expanded visitor center. And I had this reference in my head of what these various communities looked like. And the Arboretum wanted to represent 11 different southern Wisconsin plant communities in the native plant garden. So I had these great memories of places that were so striking to me. This one area of the Arboretum garden with red cedars and paper birches. And I saw that same combination at Lodi's Mill Bluff up in the Baraboo Hills. And then there's a wetland at the Arboretum where we collect roof rainwater in a basin, so to speak. And the reference for that was Avoca Prairie, 2,000-acre native prairie out near Avoca and Muscadet. And so I had these ready references, and hence the importance of field study, along with protecting natural landscapes, studying them, and designers studying native ecosystems. So it was just extremely helpful. I'd like to say I was preparing for that, for doing the native Wisconsin garden for 20 years before I did it.
Well, I tell you what, it is a beautiful garden. And I think a garden, as you talk about in the book too, it's not just for summer. You need to design something that is going to be that people are going to have a wonderful experience in regardless of the season.
Exactly. And no place expresses that better than the Arboretum Garden, where we have a lot of prairie species. And there's lots of color in the winter prairie. I was there just yesterday again. But seeing the warm russet colors, and the gold of some of the grasses, and then the patterns that they form, it's just wonderful. And certainly, I approach the point where I like winter landscapes as much as summer ones.
Yeah,
because of the rich colors. Mm-hmm.
Well, Darryl, I hope your book is selling well. I hope.
Yeah, first printing sold out, and it's in demand.
I can see why. It's a beautiful book. Your writing is wonderful. The philosophy that you bring to the book and then enhance with the wonderful photos adds to not only our enjoyment but also to our knowledge of your philosophy and the philosophy of many important landscape designers and educators. And I want to thank you so much, Darryl, for taking time to be with us today. It was a real pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry. I enjoyed it.
Darryl Morrison, his book, take a look at it. It's titled Beauty of the Wild, A Life Designing Landscape Inspired by Nature. Inspired me, that's for sure, and I enjoyed it very much. Well, we're going to switch gears on you a bit. You know what's coming up? The gun deer hunt always comes the week of Thanksgiving, and every year there's a new video put out, a new television show about the deer hunt for the coming year. And Dan Smalls, the host and producer of it, and he's coming up next. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network.